I'm James St. James. This is Night Fever, New York nightlife legends of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. I am joined by my co-hosts, the co-founders of World of Wonder, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato. Hello, boys.
Hi.
Hey.
Our guest today is a true New York City icon. He is a singer, songwriter, performer of such classics as Hip Hop Bebop Don't Stop, Boogie Down Bronx, a male stripper from his band Man to Man. These songs defined a certain era of New York nightlife. We will talk about that. He is also a party promoter. His weekly sperm party at the Cock broke records running from 1997 to 2013, 15 years.
Continuous 15 years and through snowstorms and blackouts.
And many, many, many stories from there sure to come. Welcome to the show, the gorgeous, the irrepressible, the talented Man Parrish.
Thank you, darling. So you're basically saying I'm an old queen and I'm still here is what you're saying with that introduction.
Well, we're all still here. Randy Fenton, you guys know, Man, right?
Yeah, from New York. I mean, we have mutual friends and I remember the stuff you used to do all the time. So, of course, my dog decides now to start barking. I'm sorry about that.
And we're such huge fans. We played your music all the time.
Fanatic.
You guys played it at Danceteria when you were DJing. I remember Hip Hop Bebop all the time.
Oh, like it was a heavy rotation.
There was a radio station in New York called WKTU, 92KTU. And if you guys remember, there was a robot voice that used to do 92KTU, and that was me.
Oh, I'm so talented.
I have no idea.
The talent just never stops, right? And because of that, I could bring anything up to the radio station because I didn't charge them. And they put it into heavy rotation. So it was a form of very early payola. And then once they put it to the top, we would call BLS and Kiss FM and go, what's wrong with you? Don't you realize this is breaking all records and blah, 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 blah. And then once we got New York, you would do Boston and then you would build it across the country. So it was because of payola and porn, because I got my first start in a porn movie. I may have been in a porn movie, but my music is how I got my my music is how I started in the music.
Wait, you were in a porn movie?
I think that's where we start.
Maybe.
What was it called?
It's Cell Block 9. I was working with Joe Gage. My friend was a journalist. I think he was like editor of like Inches magazine or one of the. I wasn't even aware of it at the time. And he did an interview with a 70s porn director, Joe Gage. And that's when gay porn wasn't like just stick it in. It was art. You had cruising and you had glancing for 10 minutes. It was horrible. Are you writing this down, Randy? Are you writing it down so you can get it? Good for you.
I think he's looking it up is what he's doing.
I'll tell you how you can identify me in a minute. I'll tell you.
Cell block number nine.
Yeah, cell block number nine. And I'm the guy with the wristwatch. Casey Jones, the porn star, is blowing everybody. And I'm standing there in jeans and a t-shirt with a black wristwatch. He had a fantasy of blowing guys and was from the waist down. So I you don't have to show your face. I'm getting blown by a porn star. Hey, let's do it. But what happened is I went to the back of the line for seconds. And then when I went to the back of the line for thirds, they were like, cut, you're being a pig. Get out of here. So I got a call from Joe. And he says, you want to do stuff for my movie? And I thought, porn? Yeah, I'm a 20-year-old guy. Sure. Oh, he says, oh, you don't get to see it. I just need 10 minutes here, 5 minutes there, 12 minutes here. And the song's called, the title's called Heatstroke. So they did it. It came out. And then a friend comes up to me and says, they're playing your song at the Anvil, which, by the way, I love. And I was never there before. I went to the Anvil. And the day I went there, there was Uber, the bald, fire-breathing drag queen, in a place that's all made out of wood with sawdust on the floor. I don't know how it didn't go up in flames. And Toby used to put dildos up his butt and shoot them over the heads of the audience and everybody would applaud. And I thought, oh my God, this place is fabulous. So I waited around. They played my song. I went up to the DJ booth and I said, excuse me, that, no requests. I said, that's my song. He said, what do you mean that's your song? I said, I made that song for a porn movie. The DJ took an acetate off of the porn soundtrack. It had moaning in it. So we wound up taking me up the next day to DiscoNet. If you guys were DJs, that was a DJ subscription service.
Oh, yeah.
I signed a one-page contract, you know, the firstborn, grandmother's furniture and all that. And they put out Heatstroke on DiscoNet. And at the same time, Marty Blackman from Megaton Records contacted me. Patrick Halle had died, and they wanted me to do Sylvester's Transvestor. They wanted me to do Sylvester's next record. I gave demos, but Sylvester didn't want to do electronic music because it wasn't real. So I could have done Sylvester's next record, but that didn't work out. But that's how my record career basically started. Being a whore. Be a whore.
Let's go back to the 70s there, because that's where I want to spend a lot of our time today. You left home at 14.
I left at home at 14. I had a very rough beginning. My mother was schizophrenic, tied me to a radiator. You know, it was a Sybil kind of childhood. But I was sexually abused for 3 years by a doctor, to the point that I was like bleeding back there and hiding it from my mother. So I ran away from home. My first boyfriend worked at the Continental Baths.
Well, okay, because you were the first person on this show and the only person I've ever met who was at the Continental Baths.
My boyfriend wouldn't allow me to go there because I was too young, but I lied to him that I was 18, but he knew I was younger. So, you know, he didn't know how young, but I was very tall. So we lived on 71st and Broadway, and I followed him to 74th, the Ansonia Hotel. Down in the basement was the Continental Baths. He went in and I thought, how am I going to get into this place? What is this? You know, there's all these guys going in the, it was a dark hallway with a pin spot. There was a very big club thing, black with a pin spot. And I went up to the security guard and I said, oh, I left my keys downstairs. He goes, you're not in here. And I grabbed his dick and I said, what time do you get off of work? And he said, all right, come on in. I'll meet you there afterwards. I remember walking down the black staircase with pin spots, and it was very humid. You make a turn, you go down into the room, you could hear water, and just off to the left of you was a pool with water fountains going into it. There were white morticia wicker chairs and palm trees. It was the worst form of gay possible, but then it was fabulous. Black lacquer floor and mirrors everywhere. And it was a Saturday night. I had to hide from my boyfriend who was at, they had a, in those days it was $12 to get a room for 24 hours, but they had a place where you can eat, like a little diner in the corner. And he was a short order cook. So I like stood against the walls and I hid and I wound up on the dance floor and they were setting up chairs and they said, there's a performance tonight. So I sat down and this woman comes out and performs. And she introduces herself as Bette Midler and her unknown piano player, Barry Manilow. And if you search on YouTube, there's a black and white video because they told people we're recording this. And that's when, you know, when I say gay was good, when it was in the closet, when you could cruise and gay was dirty, you know what I mean? So if you didn't want to be seen, you had to move a few rows back. So I got to see Bette Midler.
So you're not on camera. In that.
I'm not on camera. You could barely see the backs of the heads of the first row. I think they were very conscious of that.
But that is a legendary performance.
Do you remember the performance at all and what you thought of her? Did you think she's going to be a star?
It was cool. And then I remember we sat down afterwards. We helped clear the chairs and there were bean bags. And Bette came out and sat down. And said, oh, I don't know what to do. I'm going to take my $50 I made tonight. You know, take singing lessons or go get therapy. And all the queens are like, sing, darling, sing, sing. So I remember that hanging out afterwards. And then I disappeared in the back and I came out about 12 hours later.
Of course.
That was pretty eye-opening for my first time of knowing what's going on in a bathhouse, you know.
You become friends with Christopher Makos from Interview Magazine.
Yes.
Who I had no idea was a protege of Man Ray's, and that feeds into the next story that I think you're coming upon.
Yes. So I met Chris at the Herb, and you know, we kind of got along famously.
Okay, so what we're getting here is that you and Chris were sort of together a little bit at this time, kind of boyfriend.
Maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
A little bit. I wasn't his boyfriend because he had a boyfriend, but
you were the side piece.
lunch and dinner occasionally. Let's put it that way. I was the after dinner hors d'oeuvre. So Chris, you know, said, oh, you should be a model and all that. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm living in a place with no hot water and heat. I'm sweeping a gallery floor. I would borrow, ask you for $5 to borrow $5. I'd buy peanut butter and Campbell's soup and live on it for a week until the bread or the peanut butter ran out. And Chris said, well, you can make money modeling. Let me take your picture. So he took my picture and he said, I'm going to see if I can get you into Interview Magazine of like what's happening this week. The pictures came back. We went up to the factory and we're looking, you know, at which picture to choose. And Andy Warhol walks in. And I knew him from the clubs and stuff. I mean, we didn't hang out, but I knew him. And he goes, what's going on? And Chris said, oh, we're putting Manny Parrish in the paper. And Andy said, Manny Parrish? He goes, Manny, that's too common. He says, you work with Man Ray, Man Parrish. And I thought, okay, you know, like, whatever. You can, you know, as long as I get in the paper and I can show it to my friends, I'm cool. You know what I mean? So basically, it went in the paper. And then kind of people started to say, oh, you're Man Parrish. And I was very uncomfortable with it. I was like, ooh, Man Parrish. Yeah, that's me. That's me. And it kind of stopped, you know. So now it's Manny to friends and you and everybody. But it's
so Andy is the one who knighted you, who gave you your name.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize it until much later that, you know, like, what an honor. You know what I mean? We used to hang out with Basquiat, Keith Haring, Michael Musto. There was this little downtown crowd.
Well, at one point you end up with Ed Halston's apartment, which we have talked about on this show, with that with that staircase and the ultra suede couch and Liza and Bianca.
Yes, yes, yes. The Netflix didn't do it justice. They made it too. It was too square. It was very. It was rectangle. It was a townhouse. My friend, I was living in Brooklyn. My friend used to sew costumes, and we would go to Studio 54 like three times a week, but we couldn't get in. So we would park her Gremlin next door in the city parking lot. And when a limousine came to unload, we would duck down, run alongside the limousine, and pick our heads up like we were the last ones out of the limo. And we'd get in until Mark at the door, like, wait a minute, get over here. I said, Linda, you go talk to him. And then she came back and said, don't worry, we're going to get in forever. And for all these years, I thought she was fucking him. And I said to her, Linda, were you sleeping with him? She goes, my father was in the mafia, and I was dealing Quaalude. I was the Quaalude dealer at Studio 54 at like 17 years old. That's how we got in, you know? And then we got into the studio every week and stuff like that, which was unbelievable. I mean, unbelievable. So afterwards, because it was Quaaludes, we'd wind up somewhere, just jump in a cab, and you didn't know where you were going. The cab would take off, and somebody would say, take us to, you know, 58 West 60 something street or whatever. And we get out, and it's a really cool apartment. We get in, and it's Halston's. And we wind up sitting on that long couch, and there's Liza Minnelli, Andy Warhol, Diana Vreeland, Victor Hugo, which is his boyfriend, Lee Majors, Farrah Fawcett, and Truman Capote. Right? I mean, you can't make
that is the ultimate after hours past the line.
And they're passing around a giant platter, like a turkey platter filled with Coke. And everybody's, you know, like grinding their teeth. And I couldn't do Coke. I don't, I'm not good on Coke. So I didn't do Coke and I didn't drink much. So I remember all of these. That's how I got the Man Parrish stories, is because I remember all this stuff. But it was, and at the time, I was like, this is pretty cool. These people are famous, but they're not as famous as David Bowie, who was my big fan, who I got to meet later and look through his underwear drawer. And
before you tell that story, I have a naive question, because I was a wee-ish young thing. So I missed Quaaludes.
Oh.
Describe a Quaalude, what it's like. James, you've probably done dozens, right?
Oh, I've done a few, but I...
It was a drunk kind of high. It wasn't like... Not, I mean, you could nod out if you took a bunch of them, but it was like having, I'm sure James, like three vodkas and a beer, you know what I mean?
It's very stumbly. You're very stumbly.
Yeah, you're very.
And then the next day you don't remember a thing.
Messy bottom is what I would call it.
Oh, I was about to say, that sounds like my kind of drug.
Oh!
When did hip hop bebop come out. And what was that with Tony DeFreeze? How did you get?
No. Tony DeFreeze was after, which was Bowie's manager. Hip Hop Bebop came out shortly after the porn thing came out on Diskonet. There's like, people like this. Let's see if there's more. So they sent down the office boy, the guy who ran the record label. It wasn't a real record label. He was in advertising, and he did the record label out of the broom, literally the broom closet, which he cleared out and had a couple of boxes and would stuff envelopes to Diskonet. And this was the mail boy, Raul Rodriguez. He sent it to my loft and said, go listen to what this guy has. I played a bunch of cassettes. And he said, oh, this is cool. This is cool. This is cool. And Raul Rodriguez, who I work with a lot, said, I want to take you to a place called the Fun House in New York City. Now, I was like a, you know, a white, you know, I was into Euro, into, you know, erasure.
Well, you're ready to say, because we haven't talked about the Fun House here, and I've been interested in it. Can you sort of describe?
Yeah. So, he said, you know, you're a white boy. I got to put the funk in you. He took me to the Fun House. And it was a big, it turned later into where Junior Vasquez.
Sound Factory. Is that it?
It turned into, so if you're at the Sound Factory, you're at the Fun House.
Oh, I never knew that.
So we went in the back, and they had, in those days, those were the days of the mega DJ booths. And the back was maybe 800, it was the size of an apartment, maybe 1,000 square feet, the DJ booth. There was an opening where John Jellybean Benitez would spin. And next to him was a girl with long black hair and armpits. And when she turned around, it said, I'm Madonna. You know what I mean? So she was dating him. You know, that's before her stuff with Cayman's at Santeria and all that. And he said, well, this is what's going on. And they played a song and everybody went, ooh, 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 ooh. And I thought, you know what, Raul? We have that instrumental track. Why don't we bark on this record? And it'll be just a little joke. And we'll bark at them, and they'll bark at us. Done deal, right? So we wind up putting it on there. We get a test pressing. We play it. And the record barks at these kids who, if they liked it, they would bark. And they flip out. And he said, Mike, you got to come down here and see what's going on. And later on, 2 days later, he put it on a Saturday night, and they would scream and go, what's that record? What's that record? So he decided to put out Hip Hop Bebop based on those dog barks.
I was listening to that album just the other day in my car. It is so good. And I was playing it to my kids saying, listen to this. And I've always wondered about that barking.
Yeah, so that's me and Raul and all those voices. We sped the tape up. We slowed it down. Because that original piece of music was, I still can't read or write music, but I could do orchestral scores and I do it all by ear. That Hip Hop Bebop was like an ambient track with a beat to it is the best way I can kind of explain it. So I'd say, turn on the microphone and for like 3 minutes I go, hey, 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 and then give me another track, ho, ho. So when it came to mixing the track, there was no verse, no chorus, no bridge. So we did 3 10-inch reels of tape, which is, I don't know what a 10-inch reel is, like 30 or 40 minutes. So we had this incredible amount of outtakes, and we would do it with the bass, without the bass, with the vocals, with this, with it. And they took it on a Friday night, and they did MDA, Coke, and beer. And by Monday morning, those are the days when you used to edit with a razor blade. They edited together Hip Hop Bebop into what you know now, right? So it was all outtakes that then came together to make the song. So they said, we're putting this record out. And I said, you can't do that. And they're like, why not? I'd like, there's a song called Together Again. That's like the pop stuff coming out of England. People are going to laugh at me. You don't have dog barking on a record. And they said, we don't care. Even if we sell 10 copies, we'll put it out. Well, it sold 5 million copies. They bootlegged it. That's how it went to 20. And then Grand Theft Auto picked it up in 1 and 3. And that's now considered sales. So I'm at like 80 or 85 million records. Never got paid a penny on it. But we moved a lot of records.
Wow.
Here's the other thing. Back in that day, you weren't a real artist unless you had an album out. And a lot of those groups, Shannon, Alicia, a lot of those records, I worked on a lot of records back in those days that you heard that you didn't know it was Mace, Two Sisters and all that kind of stuff. But because for $50, they would pay me and I would basically write a record in the studio so I could have money to go home. I never got credit. You know, here's your $50, go home.
You say you never made money on that record?
No, it gets worse. I realized 6 months, I kept saying, I can't pay my rent. I need money. You know, well, you know, Manny, it takes like, you know, 2 or 3 years before your royalty comes in. I didn't know, you know, in lieu of $1 in a contract, I know contracts very well now, but I didn't even get the dollar. I signed publishing. I signed my rights. I think I didn't sign my name. I trademarked it. That's the only protection I have now. So I walked away from the record label, and the owner realized his golden goose is dead and came back to me one day. He said, come on, let me take you for a ride. He pulls up at a Porsche with a hand-carved dashboard. We get in. He takes me out to Teterboro. We get in a plane, and I'm like, what's this? And we take – he was a captain. He goes, oh, come on, this is fun. You know, let's go. And I said, where'd you get this plane from? You know, and he says, oh, well, it's my plane, Manny, and if you keep – make me another hit record and you'll buy me another one. And I lost it.
So other people are getting planes out of private planes off of you and you don't have money to pay the rent.
Yeah. I mean, I
you were saying you didn't have an out, like, I think you were telling a story also about you needed to have an album because you did eventually put out an album, right?
Yeah. We put out an album because he knew he didn't have to sell singles for $5.99. He stopped pressing singles and forced people to buy the album for $11.99, $10.99, whatever it was in those days. So the reason I had an album is because he was greedy, but it wound up establishing me as a quote-unquote real artist because I had an album. And that was one of the first electro albums, what you call it. It was freestyle back in then, or hip-hop. So that gave me credibility.
That album inspired me and Randy.
Oh my God!
We bought that album.
Are you kidding me?
And Six Little Synthesizers is one of my favorite songs to this day.
And you know that's Klaus Nomi singing on there
with Klaus Nomi. And that's when I thought, huh, Randy and I could be pop stars. We should do a band.
And you are. Look at you guys. Look what you did.
Well, yeah, it didn't quite work out. Yeah, you know.
But here we all are.
I should be so lucky.
I'm wondering if during this period of hip hop, bebop, don't stop, and Boogie Down Bronx, you were playing shows up in the Bronx. Is this around the time of like Grandmaster Flash and Fab Five Freddy?
Yeah, who I finally met, and he goes, "You're a legend," and I'm like, "You're a legend." So it was Grandmaster Flash, but there was a recording studio in New York, which is now the Gotham Comedy Club. That was called Vanguard Studios, run by Vanguard Records, which was a jazz label. And at night, they couldn't rent it. It was a huge orchestral thing, and jazz was almost dead. So Maynard, I can't remember his name, president of the company, he'd rent it to you for like $25 an hour, or if you cried, you'd get it the whole night for $75 or $100. So everybody was popping out records, Planet Rock, Alicia's Baby Talk, Shannon, Give Me Tonight, Freeze, A-E-I-O-U. So this was this little, what would you call it? You call it like a Muscle Shoals of electronic music in New York City. And because I was the guy with the synthesizers and the drum machines, let's call Manny and see if you pay him $50, he'll come in and he'll do all the drums and he's really good and he'll tell you what to do and you'll have a record. So we wound up working on tons of records that way in this little community of early electro in New York. Somebody's got to do Randy, somebody's got to do a little documentary on it, you know, because it is a Muscle Shoals of New York.
And there was so much great music that came out of that group.
And most of that came out of Vanguard Studios. We would mix it sometimes in other places, but there was a Fairlight synthesizer computer. It was $100,000. I couldn't afford it. But if I rented it on Friday, they were closed Saturday and Sunday. We could return it on Monday and only pay one day. For $100.
Amazing.
So like Alicia Baby Talk and all those records, we would rent it, go to my house in Brooklyn, program it, and then Sunday night we'd be going to Sunday afternoon and evening, we'd go in the studio, lay it down, do vocals, and then return the thing Monday morning, and the whole record cost $200 or $300 to make or something like that.
Oh, this is just fantastic. You're right. It's such an untold chapter, and you've got Bobby Orlando, Bobby O, Personal Records.
Yeah. Bobby Orlando, Arthur Baker.
Well, then you also, but there's also a lot of disco stars going in there where you have Gloria Gaynor and you did I Am What I Am, the great disco classic.
My tagline for Gloria Gaynor is, it was the biggest camel toe I've ever seen in my life. I did all the keyboards on I Am What I Am. I was hired again as a session singer. And she came in and like, who are you? And I'm like, I'm Manny, get out of here. And I remember looking, and she had a lime green a slack suit on and the biggest camel toe I've ever seen in my life. And I thought, you bitch.
But wait, was she a religious nut then? Because we've talked about her on the show and everybody I've heard since.
Well, I managed Village People for 6 years, which you could talk about later. But they said that it was difficult. You know, it wasn't easy working. She said, I don't understand why you guys, but they're basically a fake boy band, why you guys are leading and I'm your opening act at, like, you know, Hollywood Bowl and, you know, all these places and stuff like that. So she, I don't know if she's still that way, but back then, apparently she was a little on the tough side.
I want to talk about the New Wave Vaudeville show.
Oh, my God. Yes.
At Irving Plaza, because this story, there's so many elements going on to this story, and each one gets more fabulous than the last.
I just want to say really quickly, I was in a lot of places. I was very lucky, but at that time, New York City was a very small community. You were either into rock and roll, jazz, classical music. There was disco was sort of happening, so we went to places like Max's Kansas City, and I saw Aerosmith drive down from Boston as a, you know, a local band, the Cars, the Ramones, you know, Talking Heads. They were all kind of like kids that we hung out with. So it was a very small thing. So when things happened in that community, they were big, like the New Wave Vaudeville show and, you know, these events that happened. But the crowd was a couple of hundred people, so probably you were there.
Right. If you were around, you knew everybody and everybody knew you.
You kind of knew everybody. It was incestuous.
James, that's what Fran Lebowitz says, right? She said the scene was like literally a couple of hundred people.
It was a couple of hundred people. And I didn't work. And I was very dysfunctional from my abuse. So I went out every night. I was a true club kid, you know, like James. I got up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and then went out and clubs closed at 4, and then after hours went until noon, you know, and
I know.
I remember living on 38th Street, and I had early crazy color. I had purple hair. My top was masculine because I had a shirt and a tie, but my bottom was a skirt and yellow tights and blue capizios, walking through Times Square, you know. I don't know how I didn't get killed, you know. People are like, is that your natural color? I'm like, yes, darling, it is. I was born this way. So, yeah, it was.
So your boyfriend's with Lance Loud at this time. Let me just sort of set the table here.
Well, yeah, we were dysfunctional, broken people. So boyfriends, you know, I mean,
fuck buddies.
There was not only the fuck part of it. When you're damaged, you just want to cuddle with somebody. You know what I mean? After a while, you know, in those days, sex was very easy. There were back rooms and the trucks and the piers and West Side Highway and the bathhouses. There were 6 bathhouses in New York City. And in fact, for Gay Pride, I did a piece of artwork that was a New York City subway map. And I circled each area where there was a glory hole on the subway restrooms. So if I was coming from my house to your house, I would leave an hour early. And I'd stop at one of the men's rooms, so the glory holes, and there was glory hole etiquette. There was tea room etiquette. The last person in watched the doors. There were slats that you looked through, and if somebody came, you went, and everybody stood up and stood by a urinal. And when somebody came, you'd leave one urinal open. This was very, very direct. And if they went to the urinal and you didn't hear water drop, then she was a queen. But if not, you know, it was like, how's about those Mets? Yeah, let me wash my hands until they left. And then when that person was finished, you would go into second place and the next person in would watch the door. So, you know, sex was a lot easier. But with Lance, it was also a cuddle. You know, it was also somebody a broken person could hold and hug and just maybe get a kiss out of, too. Because as fucked up as we were, we still needed a touch. So Lance and I met through Chris Marcos and we were kind of attracted, you know, of course. You meet somebody, you have to have sex with them back in those days. I mean, that was even before you knew what their name was.
Now, is Lance in the Mumps? Is this after American Family? When is this?
Oh, American Family was early to mid-70s. I remember being at home watching it when he came to dinner with his dress on.
Very famous moment in television history, yes.
Yeah, and I thought, fierce girl. You know what I mean? I mean, I didn't know that I was saying it, but I was kind of, I mean, I was gay, but not sure if I was gay, blah, 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 blah. You know, I left home, wound up in a pedophile ring. That's a whole other story, because who's going to pick up a 14-year-old boy? And I run away from home and I go to the Rambles in Central Park.
No. We promised we weren't going to do this one. No. You've got to get back to Lance.
James, let man tell a story.
No, he has to go back to the vaudeville story, because we aren't doing the pedophile ring.
Let me do the vaudeville story, and if you remind me, I will tell it. It's a long story, but it's whack-a-doodle. But so I met Lance, and everybody called Manny because I had a tape recorder and a synthesizer. So Lance calls me up and says, they're doing the New Wave Vaudeville show. And I said, oh, what's that? You know, and he said, well, we're all getting together like... you know, let's put on a show at Irving Plaza. And I said, okay, great. He says, what do you want to do? And I said, disco is dead. Why don't we do a disco version of Anarchy in the UK, which is the most sacrilegious thing you could possibly do, right? And I said, oh, we love, great. So he says, he was at the Chelsea Hotel. He had a room on 23rd Street. And I went up to there, and we're trying to figure, I think Lance had a little keyboard or guitar or something, and we're trying to figure out the chord changes, and I'm not smart enough then about music to figure out chord changes. He goes, hold on a second. I go, where are you going? He goes, I know somebody down the hall that can help us. He runs down the hall, comes back with this junky guy and girl that were like, poof, poof, ah. And he's showing me the chords, and then he leaves. He goes, you know who that was, right? And I said, who? He goes, Sid and Nancy.
So you learned the chords for Anarchy in the UK from Sid and Nancy.
So that night was pretty special. I remember doing the disco new wave show. I got to get the dog. I will start this again if you want. Because he's just going to sit over the door and bark. I'm sorry about this, guys.
Oh, that's too good. That's amazing.
But we aren't doing it. We won't do the
pedophile. He's my Velcro dog. You know, he needs to be by me or he has a meltdown. I have three rescues.
Rescues are the best.
Yeah. So we decided to do Anarchy in the UK. We did the show, the song on stage, and we were backstage. And all of a sudden, you know, when you're in a club and you're backstage or you're DJ, there's that background of sound. It suddenly stops, and I thought, did the sound system go down? And all of a sudden, I hear, and I thought, what the fuck is that? And somebody comes in and says, you got to see this. You got to see this. So Irving Plaza has balconies, and we ran on the balcony. I remember looking down, the curtain opens, and there's Klaus with, he couldn't even afford a smoke machine. He got a smoke bomb from the joke shop. And he's got his plastic raincoat on, doing his Klausing, and he comes out and he does the aria from Samson and Delilah. I'm getting goosebumps. The aria from Samson and Delilah. And we were like, what the fuck is this? You know what I mean? And we walked back in, and Klaus is coming upstairs. I said, he sang that live. They're like, oh my God, he sang that live. He sang that. Oh my God. And they were all, Klaus, Klaus, Klaus. And I stood off to the corner, and Klaus came up to me. He goes, yeah, I heard your music and I like synthesizer, like Giorgio Moroder. Yeah, maybe we could do something. So he came to my loft on 38th Street, and we did just, I opened the microphone and I turned on Donna Summer's I Feel Love, and he sang to it, which became Confusion on his album, which I just completely redid with a Klaus tribute album that I just put out. I got his 40-year-old vocals and restored them and all that kind of stuff. So that's how I met Klaus, and that's how he wound up on Sixth Sense with synthesizers. But I wound up working for Klaus's shows. I was carrying costumes. He had a wooden stockade dress, and I would sit on the back of it so it wouldn't tilt over. And one day they turned it around, and I ate a banana as a joke, you know, a little sight gag and stuff like that.
Well, it's like wooden, and his arms go through, and his head is on top.
His arms go through it like a stockade. His arms and head went through it, and had the Klaus Nomi. You probably see pictures of it online. And I remember Joey and Adrian were wrapped up in cellophane, and we had to pick them up and put them on the stage because their feet, you know, they were like mummified in cellophane, but they were space people, you know what I mean? So Klaus was a great friend. We would talk a lot about music. His producer wanted him to do rock and roll because electronic music wasn't real, and that was just a fad and all that. And towards the end, I remember visiting him in the hospital, and, you know, he's covered with KS, and there was like a radiation, you know, thing on his door, whatever you call biohazard, and he had to put on gloves. And that day it was called GRID. It wasn't even called AIDS, and they gave you penicillin, you know, to take care of it.
They didn't know what to do. And
don't touch him, don't touch him. And I hugged him, and, you know, he cried, you know, I'm going to die. And I said, oh, no, you're not. And in those days, HIV killed you in like 3 to 6 months because the virus was way stronger than it is now. So, you know, it's before interferon and before all that other kind of stuff. But I promised Klaus on his deathbed, I said, one of these days I will figure out a way to give you the record that you want. You know what I mean? And I just recently, there's Klaus there on my manparis.com. You hit on Klaus, and I restored his 45-year-old vocals, but redid everything from scratch.
In a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
So,
and it's an amazing album too.
You heard it?
Oh yeah.
Oh great! Yeah. Thank you. That's not a money thing. That's just love for a friend.
No, but bless you for doing that.
I thank you. I feel like he didn't get what he wanted, didn't get treated properly.
I think he would be very happy with his legacy, though, because he is such a legend. And
yeah, he's not a shallow person. He was very soft and sensitive, quite opposite of what you think he would be. You think he'd be loud and boisterous, and he's
right.
Very, very withdrawn. Klaus' character was a character he stood behind, you know what I mean? So.
I do want to mention, though, there's a funny story that you tell on your Man Paris stories on YouTube, where you say that he didn't have money to pay you, but one night he takes you to...
Well, at the end of the show, Klaus was a sweetheart, and he said, I don't have much money to pay everybody because of the van, and you know, I had to pay to get all the costumes and everything. He said, but if you want, everybody, we go to Man's Country Baths. So he took the straight guys who wanted to go. There was one of the straight guys, and Joey and Adrian and me, and there was Janice who was in the show, and we put a mustache on her and a leather cap and a leather jacket. I think she wore my, and we got her into the bath.
Well, now, but this is a bathhouse that I have never heard of, and you said that it was 15 stories.
There was 6 bathhouses in New York City. Not that I ever went to them. There was there was the one in Brooklyn Heights at Pierpont Street. There was one in Wall Street for businessmen at lunchtime, the Wall Street baths. There was, I'm trying to go up, there was First Avenue, where Lips was the club baths.
Oh, that's the one that Cave Canem became.
Yeah, yeah. And then on 15th Street between 5th and 6th Avenue, there was this narrow, tall, 15-story building that was a bathhouse.
And all 15 stories were part of the bathhouse.
All 15, 14. The second to top floor was the owner had an apartment there so he could live there. And I wound up, of course, sleeping with, you know, I slept with everybody in New York, right? So, including a few celebrities who we can talk about.
But I want to know what each floor, how each floor differed.
James, we want to know about this.
Yeah, yeah. So you went, the first floor, you check in, you get in the elevator, you go up the stairs to the second floor. The second and third floor were lockers. The fourth floor was showers, the whole floor. They had those, it was new, they had those center, it was like a center thing, and you stood facing the people next to you so you could see, you can go shopping right there at the shower. No, too small, too big. Oh yeah, that's just perfect, you know what I mean? It was a great idea, you know what I mean? It was very sexual. The fifth, sixth, and seventh floor, and possibly eighth, were rooms. The ninth floor had a truck. I don't know how they got it in there, but it was a truck, and the trucks were a big thing. So when you turned the corner, there were two headlights looking at you like, what? And as you got closer, it was a cab of a truck that they hollowed out and put a bed in. And then you can walk down the length of the truck and go around the back, and you can have sex in the back of the trucks.
This is for like truck driver fantasies and stuff.
Yeah, it's a truck driver fantasy. And then they had a gym on one floor. The owner's apartment, the gym was on the top floor of the owner's apartment. The one before that, they had one or two floors of fantasy rooms. So if you wanted to be a princess, they had a pink powder puff room, or if you wanted a cowboy thing, it was like a large room with, you know, like wood dust on the floor and all that stuff. I mean, it was...
How did you avoid this, James? I cannot believe this is a part of New York nightlife.
It must have been gone by the time we got there, because a 15-story bathhouse just sounds like wonder, like Disney World.
Well, you got to realize this is before AIDS.
Yeah, yeah.
All this was before AIDS, because when AIDS came in, we thought it was like COVID. You're going to catch it from a doorknob, or you're going to catch it from the air, or if you go to a restaurant and you drink a glass, you're going to get it from that way. So everything shut down. And then the city shut everything down, the health department, because it was too dangerous. So they went after all the gay stuff.
So I don't think we're going to get out of this interview unless you give them a few names, celebrity names, because they were shooting angry looks at me when I shut that one down.
I remember going to the 4th Street peep show thing there. What was it called? It used to be Club 82. It was the 82 Club.
Yeah.
And it went downstairs and some guy pushes me in the thing and he's high out of his fucking gourd and he's fucking twisting my nipples. And I can't say it. I'm looking at him going, this looks like Terry Mugler. And sure enough, it was Terry Mugler, you know, fucked out of his gourd, twisting my nipple. And that's all he wanted to do is just, you know, tune the radio station. And I'm like, no, honey, no. Ow, no.
But wait, there's also someone who... It was a glory hole, and you told me you would tell this story.
Oops. Okay, so after my record came out, there was a short period of time I had no work. I was living in my loft, and right across the street was Hellfire Club. So I got a job at Hellfire Club because I knew the guy who ran the mine shaft, and he was running that, you know. Don't even ask, right? It's like, I want to do a whole series of Underground New York. I know all this stuff. So... Hollywood Lawn and these other people would kind of moonlight there, right? So they had a glory hole in the back, and I go around. I was security. That was my fake job. I was a big guy. I'm a big girl, plus size model. So I was security, and I'm walking around, and I see the glory hole, and there's, you know, something hanging out of the glory hole, and I went and slid into first base, and I'm like doing one of these things, and all of a sudden I go, yeah, baby. Get it, baby. Oh, baby, I'll be. And I look through the glory hole, and it's like that steeplechase Cheshire Cat, but it's got off-duty drag queen with stubble coming out, and that look, it was Hollywood Lawn. I was blowing Hollywood Lawn. So I have a claim to fame that nobody else has. I blew Hollywood. I didn't finish. I ran out of there, and there was a big bar, and I stood in the center. Come on, baby. Let's finish this. Come on to my place. And I was like, I got to get out of here. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
Bless her. Rest in peace.
You know, I used to live in the building that Hellfire was in, that triangle building on 8th. And
oh, so then you know.
Yeah, I lived right above Jay's, which was the jerk-off place.
Well, I was on the fourth floor. Lee's Mardi Gras. The first floor was a titty bar. The second floor, I don't remember what it was. The third floor was Lee's Mardi Gras shop.
Lee's Mardi Gras was a very famous transvestite boutique.
And their slogan was, let Lee dress you, he understands. And then I was on the floor above that.
And you had to know, it was like a speakeasy, you had to know about it. But then your apartment was the toilet.
Yeah, exactly. Because when I wound up on Elektra Records, the guy from Elektra Records came to see my studio. And he goes, this place is familiar. And he was married with the kids. And I went, yeah. He goes, what was this? I said, St. Carter. He goes, what was this? And all of a sudden he gets this look on his face. I say, yes, it was the toilet. And obviously you were here, but don't worry. I'll keep that between us. Yeah.
Because, you know, Jane County, I don't know if you guys remember, Jane talked about the toilet in her episode about, and we, that was a place that I'd never heard of.
The elevator would go straight up into the loft. There was no lobby, and I had a motorcycle, and I would ride it from the street into the elevator and right up into my loft, and I had a trapeze in there. It wasn't glamorous. It was unfinished. The windows were cracked and broken, and we would put up giant pieces of plastic and turn on the stove for heat. I don't know how I didn't suffocate, you know, from, you know, asphyxiation, but that was rock and roll, and that's how you lived, you know.
Tell me about working at Hellfire and just sort of describe Hellfire for people.
Hellfire was where they filmed Cruising, the movie Cruising. So it originally was a station, underground station underneath, you know, the street during the bootleg era. And at the back of Hellfire, it was closed off with brick, but there was a tunnel that went all the way up to supposedly like 42nd or 57th Street. Or no, it was where the tunnel club was on 20-something Street. Because they could take stuff in there, put it underground the tunnel, and ship the liquor down to 14th Street on a little railway system.
Now, but wait, man, I also heard that this is where the mafia used to bury their bodies, was in that tunnel.
I wouldn't be surprised. It was sealed off, and I never got to see it. But if you looked at it, you could see this is kind of arch thing, so that's where the train was. And all right, these are the columns, and this is the station. So since I knew the guy, went down there. The first time I went down there, he said, you know, it's a straight fetish S&M club. And I'd been to the, you know, the mine shaft, you know, and I was like, how bad can it be? And when I went down there, I was actually really surprised because straight fetish is different than gay fetish. Gay fetish is sex. You're getting off, someone's spanking you, whatever your trip is, you know what I mean? You're doing. In the straight world, there were these incredible, like, construction worker guys on their knees licking some woman's foot, you know? And I said, where's the sex? He goes, oh, they go home and they think about it and jerk off. It's all about this dominance mental trip. And I thought at that point, how incredible the human mind is, because you don't have to jerk off to get off. It's some sort of a mental state that you're in that satisfies you. And then I realized there was such a rainbow of sexuality out there. So that's what Hellfire taught me. I mean, we had a guy who used to come down with a stump in his arm, and he used to put Annie Sprinkle, the porn star, up on the bar and put his stump right up to her pussy. And she'd go, oh my God, he's all the way inside of me. I mean, it was out of control. It was totally out. You know, Holly would sit in the fisting sling in her, you know, her little wedding dress kind of things and just swing back and forth waiting for some guy to come by and proposition her. The cars would pull up from New Jersey outside, and these tough guys would duck down and then come up with a wig and then run downstairs because they were true cross-dressers.
Yeah, cross-dresser.
And this was the place where cross-dressers could go and not be picked on, you know. So I've seen it all, honey. Laid, relayed, parlayed, and souffled.
Let's do the Studio 54, your performance at Studio 54 for the Fiorucci party, because there's a lot there, too.
Yeah. So Joey Arias, who you guys know, a lot of people, if you don't know, you can look up. Worked with Klaus Nomi, and then when Klaus died, he worked with me, and we did shows. Joey was working at Fiorucci, and he had green hair and red hair at that time, which a lot of people didn't have, so he worked at the Fiorucci on 59th Street. It was their 10th or 15th anniversary party, and they held it at Studio 54. I got involved with David Bowie's manager because a friend of mine was auditioning for Elektra Records. Tony DeFries, which is his infamous manager, wound up wanting to produce her, and my friend Sandy said, would you please come in the studio? I'm scared. Just hold my hand. The president of Elektra Records came and go, oh my God, your man Parrish, we have to sign you. I got signed up with Tony DeFries. I put out a rock and roll kind of thing. They freaked out. They wanted Elektra. They dropped me. The day they dropped me, Tony DeFries walked away from me, and I had just come back from the cemetery burying my mother, and I had to do sound check at Studio 54. So I got out of the side door. They wouldn't let me in. I said, I'm Ann Parrish. No, you're not. Ann Parrish has makeup. I said, I'm Ann Parrish. I'm here. Anyway, I wound up getting in. They said, do you want to make an entrance? It's a big night tonight. And I said, I don't know why. I looked up and I said, I want to come down from the ceiling. You know, and they said, okay, no problem. We'll fly you. And I said, all right, whatever. So we're getting ready to do the show. We can't find our costumes. Turns out Madonna wanted to go on as the lead act and not us. She was my opening act, but the opening act was like at 2 a.m. We were on at midnight. And
But Madonna comes in and switches it on you.
It wasn't hers, her dancers, but the dancer told us later that she said to go into our room and hide our costume so we wouldn't be able to go on, so she can go on at midnight when the place is crowded. I mean, these are fabulous. This is like Hollywood Babylon. You know what I mean? These are these great stories that, you know, that are fabulous.
But wait, so you have these jackets, these graffiti jackets that the dancers wear.
These are Kanzai Yamamoto graffiti jackets. You can't see much of it up there, but that's Adrian and Joey. I had a Kanzai Yamamoto jumpsuit, which is thick corduroy, and a cape. We were into Star Wars and Dark Crystal, and I would start the show where I had a tube inside of me, and all the smoke would come out on the stage, and they'd pull it off. We had this creature and all this stuff, you know, any stuff. So
you're on the trapeze. They show this trapeze to you.
Time to get on stage. Okay, great. We end all that out. Studio 54 had scrims, and it turned out behind the back scrim, Grace Jones thought it was cool enough to have a birthday party there the same day I was performing, which was fucking awesome. So they pulled down the scrim. They had the balcony that moved back and forth. So they pulled the balcony, and they dropped this little bird perch. It's a tiny little piece of metal
that you were supposed to sit on.
Yeah. But there's no thing to hold your hands, you know, like in Cirque du Soleil. And he says, we're going to pull you up there. This is the days when they had 1,000-watt incandescent bulbs. He said it's going to be very hot up there. Do not swing back and forth because there's like 10,000 volts of neon up there. And if you smash it, you'll get electrocuted and it'll shower down glass on top of the whole audience. I thought, okay, great. So they hoist me up there. People are like this big. You know, below me, I'm looking.
How it's like 8 stories.
It's 8 or 10 stories up, and I have no net. I have no thing on my head, and I'm starting to sweat because I have this corduroy jumps flight suit on and a corduroy cape on top of it, and I'm starting to sweat, and I'm trying to clear my eyes, and it starts swinging back and forth, and the neon is like here, and then behind me, the neon is there, and the, you know, and I'm thinking, oh my God, please God, no. He said, you're gonna. After this song, we're going to lower you. I thought, okay, any minute now. And my hands are starting to slip from the sweat. And the corduroy against corduroy, it's very slippery. So I keep trying to lift myself up. Song stops and another one goes on. This is the days of 7-minute disco songs. And I thought, there must be a technical problem. Okay, I'm up there for like 10 minutes now. And all the 1,000-watt bulbs are coming up there. And it must have been 110 degrees up there. And I'm starting to freak out. That song ends, and another song comes on.
And, like, literally, you're about to slip off any second.
Well, it's rock and roll. That would have been the show, right? You know, Queen dies at Studio 54, legendary, you know what I mean? So, I'm screaming, but this was a Richard Long sound system with, you know, huge bass cabinets, and I'm screaming, get me! Finally, we get lowered down. My boyfriend at the time was a terrible alcoholic. He was supposed to put this much, like maybe 6 inches of smoke on the stage for effect. He dropped the dry ice. That's when you had dry ice and hot water and a fan. Dropped the dry ice, and there's something like a story and a half of, you know, ice, because he just got drunk and, like, you know, wasn't paying attention. So I thought, why don't I jump a few feet higher? The cape will pull out, and I'll glide down the stage. Well, I dropped about a story and a half, twisted my ankle. Thank God I didn't break it. But Joey's on stage, I'm on stage, and we couldn't see each other. Because we're in a complete whiteout. We couldn't find the edge of the stage. And the audience is going, oh my God, this is incredible. This is incredible. So we did the whole first song, which was man-made in total smoke. And they were like, this is the most incredible thing I've ever seen in my life. You know what I mean? So, and then afterwards, I was up in the dressing room, like, freaking out. I thought, they're going to kill me. You know, they're going to be really angry at me. And these two guys come up with leisure suits, these big black, you know, bodyguards, and they said, Mr. Jackson would like to see you. And I thought, oh God, it must be one of the owners. I'm in trouble. And they took me downstairs, little VIP area, and Michael Jackson was sitting there. I said, hello. And I said, hi, Mr. Jackson. No, it's Michael. And I said, well, hi, Michael. He goes, I really like your music. And I said, I really like your music. He said, would you like to do a remix? I'm doing a new album. At that time, Michael Jackson didn't want to do the pop music because all this electro was coming out, and he wanted to change his sound, and he was experimenting with electro and hip-hop, bebop type of sounds. He said, I have a new album and a track on it called Speed Demon. Would you like to do it? And I said, yes. And then it's all right, someone will be in touch with you, and, you know, they pick you up and they just get you out of his face. He wasn't super, super famous, but he was pretty big then. And I thought, this is never going to happen. And about 2 weeks later, I got a call from Quincy Jones, Q West, and they sent the tracks over. I did a hip hop bebop version of a Speed Demon. And Quincy liked it. Michael Jackson hated it. And it's sitting in a vault somewhere at Sony. You know,
that's crazy.
Yeah. That's a little thing at the end of that story.
Did you see Madonna perform that night finally?
Yes, she jumped onto a cake. And she was on the balcony. By 2 o'clock, everybody left, and she jumped onto the cake and slid down, and everybody applauded. And she sang. It wasn't Holiday. It was at Holiday. I can't. It was one of a very, very, very early songs.
Burning Up, maybe.
Even before.
Everybody.
One of those. Yeah. Everybody. Okay. I think it was Everybody. That's what she had. And she sang Everybody, and then left. I played with her 2 times. After that, at the Red Parrot with Soul Sonic Force, me and Madonna, she went on last. And then she complained that we ruined the audience because the audience was exhausted from yelling at us. You know what I mean? And we ruined the show. You know what I mean? That's the kind of stuff you want to hear. And then we played out in the Hamptons with her one other time. And then I wound up in the English newspapers as fucking Madonna.
Oh.
You know, News of the World. And all those wonderful classic papers, the Standard, News of the World, and I can't remember the other one. Yeah, which is a whole funny story in itself.
That's when you had gone to, you were promoting Male Stripper.
Male Stripper, I wasn't supposed to be in the country without getting a work permit. They wanted me to do a remix, so I had to come in as a tourist. So there was this insane queen who worked, very small label, but we lucked out with Male Stripper, and it was climbing the charts. It was like number 4. But they, all right, why don't you come over and at least mix a record? I'm like, oh, okay, free trip to England. Let's go. I've never been there before. So I get off the plane, and he says to me, he goes, Manny, he goes, we have to talk to the press. And I said, what are you talking about? He goes, well, your record's really big. I said, why would the press be interested in me? He goes, oops, I forgot to tell him. I told them you're fucking Madonna. And I went, what? And there's like 5 or 6 people who came out of customs standing there. And I said, are you kidding me? I'm not doing that. He goes, darling, you have to do it because if you don't do it, they'll destroy you. The English press will destroy you. I said, I don't care. I'm tired. Just let's do it, whatever. We went to a hotel. They had a dais set up. They had about 15 to 20 press people. And the first, and we sit down and say, I said, give me your sunglasses. I put them on. I'm going, please, God, please, God, please, please, you know, make this go away. And the first question is like, so what's it like sleeping with Madonna? And I went, oh, my God. He said, oh, Manny's got scratch marks on his back because they have sex so hard that she's clawing at him. And I thought, what? And I'm trying to hold a face on this thing. And I'm going, are you fucking kidding me? And then the next question is, what about Sean Penn? Oh, they call him Poison Penn and they laugh at him and they make jokes about him. And I thought, okay, they're not going to believe this. And then the final one is, well, how does Madonna get to Manny's house in Brooklyn? I was living at my mother. Oh, he's got a black maid named Beulah who's got an old 60s Ford who rolls her up in a blanket, pulls her up to Manny's door. The door opens and Madonna sneaks in and they have sex for 3 days without eating and drinking and sleeping. And I thought, this is so crazy. They were never going to press this. Well, you know, News of the World and all these papers, it's on the front page. They knock on the door the next day, and I was in a hotel in Earl's Court where you have to put 5 pence in to turn the heat on. It was like that classy, you know what I mean? And in front of the newspaper, Madonna longs for my baby. And I said, I'm going to get in trouble. Oh, no, darling, don't worry. I have all week set up. We don't have to buy food, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I've scheduled all of our interviews, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and they're paying for the story. By the end of the week, I got really scared, and I said, I can't do this anymore because I didn't know. Could I get sued? He goes, I got a great idea. We're going to put you in a hotel room with a girl, and I have one with a connecting balcony. We're going to get the room next door, let the press guy in. He's going to come out to the balcony and shoot into the room of you cheating. And I thought, great, it'll be over. So she's looking out the window. I'm there. She has, you know, like her shirt pulled down to here. We had the covers up. She goes, there's somebody there. And he went, hey, you. And as I did the you, he snapped the picture and it wound up on the papers the next day. And that was the end of that.
That you were cheating on Madonna. And so that's how you broke up with her.
Court cheating, kiss and tell, Madonna's lover, or something to that effect. And then my father called me and said, the National Enquirer and Entertainment Tonight called me, wants to know about you, and who's Madonna? And I said, don't answer the phone. Don't answer the phone.
Did she ever find out about this, do you think?
Did she? Of course, she was on national. She was in the national newspapers. It was. I was on Entertainment Tonight. Of course, she knew about it. Yeah, absolutely. I never heard. Well, actually, her brother Chris challenged me to come to Chicago and come on his cable TV show because he wanted to say, "You're sleeping with Madonna. Come on the show. Let's talk about it." So she obviously knew about it. If he knew about it, you know.
Man, let's talk a little bit about the cock, because it. I remember it. I didn't go that much, but I remember Mario Diaz. I'm a good friend of Mario's, so I know the stories. Tell us a little bit about the cock when you first found it and what it was like and how you what you did to it.
I was working over at the Lore, which was leather, uniform, rubber, etc., over on the West Side Highway. Wednesday night, they had a party called Pork, which was kind of like the hip. Wasn't leather, but fetish. It was the boys' party. It wasn't the glam party. It was the boys' answer to the young boys' party. And one of the guys said they opened up a bar on the east side. It's Red Rooster, but everybody calls it the Cock. And I said, "Oh, that sounds cool." He goes, "They're looking for promotional parties, and I want to branch away from Pork. Would you like to do a Sunday party?" We went over there. It was 2 months after the Cock opened, I think in September, October. We were there in December. And I remember Mario interviewed us and, "All right, whatever, you can have Sunday night." And the first night we went in, I remember I got up on the bar. Pork had decorated, so we were going to decorate. And I fell off the bar and it was Mario and a couple of other vicious queens. And they went, "Oh, this one's a fucking klutz. They're never going to survive." So introduction to the Vipers at the Cock. So we ran 15 continuous years. The capacity for the club was 87 people. Friday and Saturday did about 200 people. Our Sunday parties did 400 people. The floors would bend. We would come there at 8 o'clock in the morning. I know, it was like the world.
I worked at the world. I remember that very much.
You know, if you were downstairs, that chandelier would swing because the floor was going.
Yes, like, terrifying.
So we would get in there at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning, and I would put a large part of the budget into fake fur, plastic. We would take the banquettes and we would make small rooms and little mazes out of it. I put money into lasers that were technically illegal because they would burn your retina. But I programmed lasers for 2 hours and computerized, like, you know, lights with mirrors on them, which were big in those days. And every Sunday, we just did something else. You wrapped it in bubble wrap, wrapped it in fabric, made a tent. You know, we made Alice in Wonderland where you had to crawl through the rabbit hole to enter the club and stuff like that. And I had live performers. I had Guy Ehner, who would paint in his jockstrap doing...
I love Ehner! I love him, yes!
And we'd have Jennifer Snackwell sitting on a trapeze at 400 pounds. And she came up to me, she goes, "I don't know what to do this week." I said, "Take your bra, I'll pay for a bra. Cut holes out of it and put 2 cans of Cheese Whiz. Dump a bunch of Ritz crackers in your purse. Go up to somebody and say, 'Excuse me, honey, you look a little thin.' Pull your tit out, give them a little Cheese Whiz and feed it into their mouth." So we were creative every week with the craziest thing. Mike Ford was at the door. He worked with Mother, you know, and then for me. And each week he would put on these incredible outfits. And I paid everybody 3 times what you normally get paid because I really wanted them to work with me. Javier, who did the box, was my bartender.
I love Javier, yes.
Yeah, it was my bartender, you know what I mean?
So hot, hot bartenders, hot, hot go-go boys that were naked.
Well, that's something that we started because we had a back room. So we inherited the back room. I didn't care much about the back room. Sperm was not meant to be a sex party. A sperm was supposed to be an art party, and a sperm was a new seed and a new beginning and, you know, whatever. But there was a back room and people came for the back room. When we had Go-Go Boys, Javier and what was the other one? I can't remember. Anyway, I'd say, get the Go-Go Boys drunk, but use Jägermeister. And they'd give him like half cupfuls of Jägermeister. And I knew by midnight or 1 o'clock, it was a Sunday night, the cops wouldn't come. They were all home fucking their wives, you know what I mean? So we couldn't get them naked from 10 to midnight or 1 o'clock. So they would rub their butts while they were dancing and massage their dicks and get them drunk and turned on. And then they'd slip their hands up behind them and pretend they were holding their buns and then throw their underwear down and toss it over to me in the DJ booth. And I'd throw it into the corner on the floor. And they were like freaked out. And all of a sudden, their money went through the roof to the point that at one time, I think we had 12 before Daniel Nadicio. I mean, I wound up doing Triple X with Johnny McGovern, me, and who's the other person? I can't remember the other person, Triple X, but this was before all that. We had naked go-go boys, and we would have girls from NYU coming to the door. Is this the party where the guys are naked on the bar and stuff like that? But their money, they would make they were like female strippers. They'd make $400-$600 a night being naked because nowhere else in town you could do that.
And then eventually the patrons started getting naked.
Oh, my God. So one day I'm DJing and I look to think, and a guy with just sneakers on walks by naked. And I'm like, well, it's sperm. And he comes up to me. He says, I hope it's okay. I said, it's totally okay. He goes, okay, good. Because I have four more friends of mine back there. We're all nudists. And we were wondering if it's okay. I said, honey, I'm going to introduce you to Billy at the door, my boyfriend. You can come in any week you want for free, only on Sunday night, and get naked. And they did. So it was quite wild. I had a DJ, but then I learned how to DJ because I wanted to DJ music. I wanted to do party music. I didn't want to do dark, underground music and stuff like that. So I learned how to DJ from doing that. You know what I mean? So
you invented the blackout parties.
Yes, we did. Yeah. We had to come up with things to do. And I thought, well, the back room's dark. Why don't we turn all the lights out? And then I went, boy, is that going to be fun? So when you came in, you got a glow stick. And they told you at the door, good luck. Because that glow stick would only last about an hour. And if you came in at 11 o'clock, by 3 o'clock in the morning, it was barely a glow, barely a glow stick. But what I would do is I would open up to me and the bartenders and security had, we got miner's caps. So that's all you could see. And I had lasers. So I had one green laser running down the length of the cock. Everything else was pitch dark. And people fucking loved it. And I would open up the glow sticks and swing it around. And it would put like stars all over the ceiling. And then they would fade out. And you put stuff on my cardigan sweater. And I'm like, honey, you're in the wrong place. If, you know, you're at the cock at a blackout party. I'm sorry, you precious. You know, Armani sweater got a little, you know, your cardigan sweater got, you know, a stain on it, but, you know, send me the bill. Of course they wouldn't, but they were quite famous. And of course, then everybody else started doing them.
But now Mario sort of screwed you guys over by giving an interview with HX Magazine.
Yeah. So when the cop needed promotion and he got an HX Magazine, they said, well, what's the cock about? Oh, we're rock and roll fag bar and, you know, everything, including a back room. And HX said, back room? Isn't that illegal? Won't Giuliani? He goes, fuck Giuliani. I don't give a fuck. We're doing the back room.
Not something to put in print during that period in which Giuliani is on his quality of life tour.
Yeah, a few days later, the cops come and they shut the place down. And then it's lawyers for 2 days. And it was shut down for 2 months. And it was a $20,000 fine. Come back up again. Mario gives an interview to another thing and says, fuck them for fucking us. I'm going to fuck them.
Oh, God.
And then they shut us down again for a month. And that was a $40,000 fine.
And you would think Mario would have learned his lesson.
Well, he wound up, the owner was like, you know, see you later. Because now you're fucking with my liquor license. And then it became, you either worked at the cock and they went over to the boys' room. So it was either the cock or the boys' room. It was the Hatfields or the McCoys. And you either work one or the other. And I'm like, this is so fucking stupid. Like, I would want to book some. I can't because I'm booked at the boy or the dancers. I'm booked at the boys' room if they know I'm going to be dancing here. But they wound up. I mean, we stopped paying dancers because these. One day I was in there and I had video of it that this guy comes in, gets up on stage, and his dick is like, you know, 11 inches soft. And he's leaning over, blowing himself. And they're going, some guy's blowing himself on the stage. And me, the pervert, I'm like, oh, my God, I got to see this. Let me get my, I had a low light video, a night vision video camera, and I'm filming it. And then afterwards, I said, you know, you can come back any week you want, and I'll pay you a couple hundred dollars. He goes, oh, no, I just got out of Rikers Island. And they told me in Rikers Island that if you want to make money, bus money to get back upstate to Buffalo, go to the cock, pull your dick out. For 2 or 3 hours, and you make several hundred dollars, and you'll be able to. So we were famous in Rikers Island.
The Rikers Island is your best promotion. Well, I do want to tell everybody to go to YouTube and watch Man Parrish Stories, because these stories are...
Stories, or the easier way is just go to manparrish.com, and there's a little link there that says stories. People say, you got to write a book. And I tried several times, and I had people, it didn't work out. So I decided to put a camera in front of me against a green screen, which I turned black, and I turned it black and white, and I used a ring light to get rid of the wrinkles, and it's unedited. It's raw. It's 5 minutes, seven, maybe 10 minutes at the most. I tell stories like when I got to hear Young Americans off the 24 track at Electric Lady Studios. And there was a handsome black guy that was the backup singer. And that turned out to be Luther Vandross. I tell stories about I was hustling, and then this mafia guy, I was counting counterfeit 20s, and the FBI came in, and I had to testify against, you know, some mafia guy that set them up the river. You know, we're all afraid we're going to get killed. So I got wackadoodle stories, but they are, swear to God, all true and stuff like that. And I tell these stories because, as outrageous and entertaining as they are, there's a sad side to it, that a kid had to leave home at 14 that was physically, sexually, and mentally abused. And somehow or another, a couple of French fries showed up a Happy Meal, but survived. So I want people to know that, you know, as rough as you have it, and as rough as I have it, there's people that have it way rough than me. If you can hang in there, no matter what it is, you'll survive. My therapist said, you know, you're not a junkie, you're not an alcoholic, you're not in a straitjacket, and you didn't kill yourself. You know, so you have to look at that as strength. So I take that strength, and I tell stories in hopes that you're going to laugh, you're going to cry at some of these stories, but when you start piecing it together, it's like, holy shit, it's cool, but it's really sad that a 14-year-old kid had to be a 30-year-old kid learning how to survive in the streets of New York. So, yes, it had Halston and, you know, gray stones that are coming down from the ceiling and all that, but the other side of it is, I just want people to know that, you know, don't let your head get in the way. You can make it, you know, you can kind of make it. I'm still trying to figure it out, but, you know.
We should be so lucky to have lived a life as full as yours. I mean, really, it's just, yeah.
So if I was to do it again, I think I would. I mean, because I wound up where I am now, a lot freer to think, a lot more comfortable with myself. I live in New York and Florida, and I'm doing more music now than I've ever done in my life because I dealt with my demons, and my head, my spirit, whatever it is clear, and I can focus on what I'm doing. So I'm doing crazy amount of work right now, which is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful.
Randy Benton, congratulations. I watch I see your career and what you guys have built, and it's amazing. So bless you.
By the way, that's very kind of you, and it's so we have been long fans of yours. Yeah. So this has been great.
And of yours.
It's just an honor to spend time with you. Really, it's like it's a dream come true.
I'd love to be an evil judge on Drag Race. I remember RuPaul when she was dancing on the bar at the Pyramid when I played there with Bunny and with Happy Face. You know what I mean? So the good old days. Thank you, my darlings. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much for being here.